We hope to see y'all there.
KVOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Requiem for a Rogue, Portland debut and benefit on Saturday, November 30th from 9 p.m. to midnight at the Atlantis Lounge in Portland. This is the Portland debut of Dan Kaufman's band's Modern Western Opera and a benefit to stop a fossil fuel pipeline in Oregon. Requiem for the Rogue tells the fictional story of a Southern Oregon landowner who runs afoul of a modern-day Sheriff of Nottingham, who is in cahoots with a fossil fuel pipeline company. Again, that's Requiem for the Rogue, Portland debut and benefit on Saturday, November 30th, from 9 p.m. to midnight at the Atlantis Lounge at Mississippi Pizza, 3552 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kvoo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. You don't own the water.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 11 o'clock. Time for Between the Covers with host David Naiman.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is the poet Jake Skeets. Skeets is a graduate of the MFA program at the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe, New Mexico. His poetry and prose have appeared in Plowshares, The Rumpus, Word Riot, Waxwing, Yellow Medicine Review, World Literature Today, and at the Poetry Society of America, among many others. Skeets edits Cloudthroat, an online magazine for Native, First Nations, and Indigenous writing and art. He also organizes the poetry salon and reading series Pollen Tongue, is a member of the Diné Writers Collective, and teaches at Diné College in Arizona. Jake Skeets is here today on Between the Covers to talk about his debut collection of poetry published by Milkweed Editions, entitled Eyes Bottled Dark with a Mouthful of Flowers, and selected by Kathy Fagan as a winner of the 2018 National Poetry Series. Tommy Orange says, Jake Skeets writes, with such sparse yet full beauty, you sometimes don't know where the source of the power of these poems comes from. It is in the power of his language, in the craft, of course. It is in how the brutal experience of pain and loss can become a thing of beauty, which is where grace lives, which is where the best art comes from. There is so much bottle dark beauty here. Skeets is a new essential voice in poetry, in literature. D.A. Powell adds, Jake Skeets takes us to the quote-unquote Indian capital of the world, a landscape of erosion and erasure, where boys only hold boys like bottles, and Eros is a dangerous thing. In the brush and horseweed, ghosts and trains and abandoned trailers, a young Diné attempts to answer all the question marks of adolescence and early adulthood, desire and death commingling around him. These are poems born of unspokenness, testing the limits of language, love, and silence. Lastly, Kathy Fagan says, on its surface, Eyes Bottled Dark with a Mouthful of Flowers is an examination of toxic masculinity through the lens of a queer Indigenous Southwesterner, a book in which alcoholism, violence, and sex under cover of night are both ruefully and sensually described. But experiencing Jake Skeets' collection is more akin to listening to a musical score to, or watching the choreography of, one Diné man's vivid boyhood, the family and community of that boyhood, and the landscape holding them all. Indeed, like a lover, the land of these poems enters and ornaments Skeets' men, old and young, dead and alive. His images haunt, and his use of repetition, field, and fragment provide the book's structural genius. He's a major debut that feels to me timely and timeless. Welcome to Between the Covers, Jake Skeets.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you had originally thought of working on two separate poetry collections, but then ultimately came to realize not only that they were connected, but that their themes, which seemed separate, were perhaps inseparable. Can you talk first about the two projects as you first conceived them, and then about how you came to realize that maybe for you these were one project?
Yeah, definitely. I think when I first started my MFA program at IAIA, I was very obsessed with first books. I had a lot of sort of inspiration coming from first books, so specifically books like Ocean of Wong's poetry collection, Saeed Jones, Derek Austin, these types of poets who sort of did the job of the body, I think, really just understanding the body and really writing a collection surrounding the body. So that was the type of collection that I was very interested in. And so that's the type of collection I wanted to write, was just the sort of what I call a coming out collection, right? The debut of a queer poet, right? Talking about the body, talking about desire. And then sort of midway through my program, I decided to move back home to the reservation. And I saw this place, Gallup, New Mexico, as an adult this time, because I had left when I was 18, right? Right after high school, I went to college. And so this is my first time like back, like actually living at home. And I sort of saw all this violence again for the first time, it seemed like. And that's when this sort of collection shifted into this collection about Gallup. And so for the longest time, I was trying to juggle this idea of the body and this idea of landscape and Gallup. And so I thought I was writing these two collections. Maybe, you know, I would have the body collection come out first, then maybe a collection about Gallup. But then as I started to really delve into what it meant to be a queer poet and what it meant to be a Diné poet, I began to see how I couldn't separate my queerness from that violence. Hmm. That my queerness was sort of blossoming within that type of space. So it was really interesting for me to be in a position where I had to come to terms with brutality, come to terms with violence. And I think for me to do that, it was through craft, and it was through this concept of beauty, which I borrow from my own sort of upbringing as a Diné person.
Hmm. Well, one thing that you've said is that you discovered that an energy exists within the land, and that even when you purposely drove your poems away from Gallup, away from masculinity and away from queerness, that through some unconscious part of yourself, these spaces found themselves in your poems, and that the poems kept placing themselves in Gallup. Much like Layli Long Soldier opens Whereas and Mitchell S. Jackson opens Survival Math, your collection opens by summoning the specificity of place. So I thought maybe we could start by grounding listeners in Gallup, New Mexico, for people who don't know it. Can you orient us to Gallup as you know it? And yeah, also the mythology of Gallup as well.
Yeah, definitely. I just had the panel about myth, and we're talking about the idea of the American West, the idea of American progress. And I feel like Gallup is such a hidden central place for all of that, both manifest destiny, both expansion into the West, but also even myths like old Hollywood, right? Gallup is such an interesting place where all these different histories and lineages come together. So in terms of Gallup itself, it sits on, you know, the historic Route 66. It's definitely a railroad town. It's named after David Gallup, who was the paymaster for the railroad. And it sits in a place that is adjacent to several Native nations. So for example, it's so close to the Navajo Nation. In fact, it's parts of Gallup are considered Navajo Nation because it's sort of a checkerboarded area is what they call after the Allotment Act. So you would have like one section be, you know, reservation, then you would drive, you know, 5 minutes to the east, and then you'd be in, you know, the private land of Gallup or that type of different ownership. And it also sits next to the Zuni Pueblo, which is about maybe 20 minutes south of Gallup, and then the Laguna Pueblo, which is maybe about an hour east. And of course, we have Hopi within Navajo. So it sort of sits within a place where it's so adjacent to all these different communities, which is why, of course, it's labeled the Indian capital of the world. And so generally what that means is because it's a border town, it sits at the border, families from these communities will drive into Gallup to, you know, purchase groceries, purchase supplies for their homes, which is what I did as a child. I didn't grow up specifically in Gallup. I didn't have a house there, but I grew up 10 minutes south of it. And so we would often drive to Gallup daily for, you know, just daily tasks, and then sort of haul everything back home. So within that sort of structure, you had, you know, the boom of liquor stores and bars within Gallup, which really gave rise to the alcoholism that sort of exists, that existed and exists still in Gallup. And so it's it has all these different type of histories attached to it. And in the book, I try to delve into all of them, the resource extraction, railroad, the alcoholism issue, and also old Hollywood, right? The idea of, like, because there's a hotel in Gallup called Dale Rancho Hotel where all these celebrities have stayed. And so I have a poem called A List of Celebrities Who Stayed at the Dale Rancho Hotel, just to, you know, have that old Hollywood element, just to have this weird engagement between someone who's a celebrity versus someone who is considered a drifter in Gallup.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, one of your poems also references an article by Nick Estes called Blood Money, Life and Death in Gallup, New Mexico, which describes some of the things you say. Also lets us know that Navajo make up almost half the population, that it's the poorest county in New Mexico. And like you mentioned, the liquor industry has a stranglehold over the city, and the FBI calls it the most dangerous city in New Mexico, where violent, unnatural deaths for Native people are an everyday occurrence. And he also points out in that article that Native people are the most likely population to be killed by police officers nationwide, and that New Mexico ranks number one in deaths by police of any state in the United States. And Gallup has two nicknames, I guess, one being Indian Capital of the World and the other one being Drunk Town. And I was hoping maybe we could hear that poem, Drunk Town, that is near the beginning of your collection.
Drunk Town. Indian, Eden, open, tooth, bone, bruise, this town split in two. Clocks ring out as train horns, each hour hand drags into a screech, iron, steel, iron. The minute hand runs its fingers through the outcrops. Drunk town, drunk is the punch, town a gasp. In between the letters are boots crushing tumbleweeds, a tractor tire backing over a man's skull. Men around here only touch when they f**k in a back seat. Go for the foul with 30 seconds left. Hug their sons after high school graduation. Open a keg. Stab my uncle 47 times behind a liquor store. A bar called Eddie's sits at the end of the world by the tracks. Drunk men get some sleep. My father's uncle tries to get some under a long bed truck. The truck backs up to go home. I arrange my father's boarding school soap bones on white space and call it a poem. Like my father, I come upon death, staggering into the house with beer on the breath. Mule deer splintered in barbed tendon, gray highway, veins narrow, push, pull under teal and red hills. A man is drunk staggering into northbound lanes, dollar bills for his index and ring fingers, sands glitter with broken bottles, greens, deep blues, clears, and golds. This place is White Cone, Greasewood, Sanders, Whitewater, Bread Springs, Crystal, Chinlee, Naslini, Indian Wells, and all muddy roads lead from Gallup. The sky places an arm on the near hills, on the shoulder, dark gray, almost blue, bleeds into greens, blue greens, turquoise into hazy blue, pure blue, no gray or gold or oil black seeped through. If I stare long enough, I see my uncle in a mirror. The bottle caps we use for eyes. An owl has a skeleton of three letters. O twists into L. The burrowing owl burrows under dead cactus. Feathers fall on horseweed and skull bone blown open.
Been listening to Jake Skeets read from his collection Eyes Bottle Dark with a Mouthful of Flowers. Perhaps similar to the way you've brought two collections into one, or the way that Gallup has two ways it is described, you've described this collection as an attempt also to not polarize beauty and brutality, to ask the question of what it would mean if we considered them simultaneously or even discover one within side of the other. And you have a series of poems that punctuate the collection or perhaps serve as connective tissue in the collection called In the Fields. And they're very different formally. One is seven words, one is a prose block, one is scattered letters, and one is formed in couplets. But they all share the same name, and I wonder if they also share a common function as we travel through the poetry and spend time in each of these fields. So I was hoping maybe you could talk to us how you envision and employ the In the Fields poems.
The field itself is such a huge place for me as a poet. And so when I first began the Fields poems, I was sort of struck by the way people sort of approach the American West or just the Southwest in general. I feel like the desert has always been a place of this like cosmic or mythological reflection for people, right? You think of like the Doors, right? This idea of like the psychedelic desert or the electric desert, or you go out to the desert and you find yourself, right? And then there's also the notion that the desert is somehow foreshadowing a bit, right? You sort of look out into the fields and you see this dark rain cloud, right? And then that's automatically considered foreshadowing of something darker that's coming or something that's looming in the distance, right? And so for me, I was very interested in that and I wanted to speak back to it or speak against it in some way. So because for me, back home, the fields are places for reflection, definitely, but not in the sense of I'm gonna find myself in these spaces. It's more so I'm going to experience this particular place with, you know, concepts of beauty, concepts of recognition and acknowledgement of everything existing within that field, right? So not only wildlife, but plant life, but also just the forces that created that particular field, right? So you have erosion, you have wind, gravity, those types of things that sort of shape it. And so for me, the Fields poems became literal fields for the reader to sort of step back and reflect or step out of the collection a little bit and just find themselves again. And also recognize the energies that exist within them. Hmm. Yeah, so it's for me, because I knew the collection was going to be very grief heavy, the Fields poem came way after I was sort of finished with the collection for the most part. I wanted places where the reader can have a platform or just a quiet space where they can just, you know, calmly collect themselves again. But of course, those fields, right, are also the same places where men went to sort of learn their bodies or learn desire, much like me, but also they became a place where men would also lose their lives. And of course, the In the Fields, that phrase came from the Nick Estes collection. I'm not sure if you read it, but he also lists all these people who were found dead in the fields. He sort of goes through the list, and that's where the listing sort of came across in the collection as well.
Could we hear the In the Fields on page 76? And then also, I was thinking maybe after that we could hear After Party.
In the Fields, with lines from D.A. Powell. We unyoke owl pellets from marrow in desert meadow. His mouth a pigeon eye, a torch, a womb-turned flower. He still a boy dug from cactus skull undresses into bark beetles. he unlearns how to hold a fist with my hand, bursts into dandelion seeds. We are all beautiful at least once. Mud water puddles along enamel. Eye teeth blossom into osprey. Our bones dampen like snow melt under squirrel grass. We could be boys together finally, as milk vetch, tumbleweed, and sticker bush. We can be beautiful again beneath the sumac, yarrow, and bitter water. After party. We tank down beer, eyelids lower and lower. He lets me feel beneath his basketball shorts. Sorrel feels along his thigh, burrows in our bellies, heavy and heavy from Rolling Rock and Blue Ribbon. Aluminum ghost coaxes his kiss. Candle left lit. He mouths the neck and lip of another bottle, rifle cold. My tongue coils on the trigger before its click. Corn beetles scatter out, no longer his bones.
I've been listening to Jake Skeets read from Eyes Bottle Dark with A Mouthful of Flowers. So I read somewhere that the word Navajo, possibly given to the Diné people by the Anasazi, originally meant the field people. I don't know if that's true. And in one place this was explained as being because the Diné were a pre-colonial agricultural tribe. And then in another place that I discovered a talk by a Navajo elder, that the explanation was that at the age of four, children are taught that they are themselves a field. And I have no way to verify either of these, but I wondered if the idea of the field people was something you were conscious of when writing the field poems.
Yeah, no, I don't think I've heard specifically that type of translation. I've actually heard several, but it does sound very similar to what I've heard, right? Because I've heard that Navajo itself, the word Navajo can mean a lot of different things, right? So like the idea of, you're right, being like you know, agriculturalists or farmers. Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of different translations from what I heard. I've even heard that it means like thief as well, right?
Oh, wow.
For me, Navajo is such a really interesting word because I can't really trace an origin in myself. People say Laguna Pueblo gave it to us. Some say it's a Spanish word. So there's really sort of no origin for it. But you're right, in terms of our ancestral name, right, Diné, that is literally translated to the people, which is very similar to a lot of different tribes across the country. And so I think the way we approach the field, the idea or the concept of the field, is through the recognition of its energy. Back home, there's a specific sort of thought process or life way that Diné follow. And it's sort of guided around the idea of process and structure. When we talk about, I'm also a teacher at Diné College, and we also have sort of an educational philosophy that was rooted in Diné thought and life way. And so it's called like a philosophical model, and it has four steps. The first step is nsakes, which means like critical thinking. Right, so the fact that whenever you start anything in your life, even if it's just your day or a new project or you're going to wash the dishes, right, there's always this step of where you have to think about what you're going to do. And then there's the second step, which is nata, right, the idea of planning or making sure that you're going to do whatever you need to do in a way that's effective and essential, and you're being respectful. And then there's ina, which means life. Which is doing the thing, or you're living, or you're going through the process. And then the last step is sihasin. And so for me, what that means is reflection. Mm-hmm. And so sihasin is such a huge part of my life because of those fields, right? I was very interested in, again, the concept of the field as reflection. And so sihasin is such an important part of being who I am, being a Diné person, it's such a crucial sort of step. And of course, that's what I teach my students as well, is that it's often a step that's overlooked, right? We don't often think about what we've done or think about what we've said. I think there's always a good way to sort of look back at yourself or look into a mirror. And for me, that's what the fields are. They also function as mirror.
Well, when I see some of the field poems having a lot of white space or words that are scattered across the page, I wonder if you see the page as a sort of field, but you sort of answer the question already in an incredible essay that I'm going to point people to at World Literature Today called Poetry as Field. And I was hoping you to unpack the opening lines for us, which are, there is a field, we don't question its meaning or try to find narrative or accessibility. There is simply a field.
When I approach poetry as an instructor, as a teacher, I always try to mention that we read poetry not the way we read prose, like fiction or nonfiction. And so what I call it instead is more experiencing poetry. And I have this sort of thought process or thought exercise where I have the sort of either my students or if I'm leading a workshop, have them close their eyes and think about that they're hiking, that they're outside, that they're sort of hiking up this big hill and I'm asking them to populate what they see, right? If there's like a really big forest or if it's just scattered, but they're going up this hill and then they come across this field. And I ask them to populate that field with things that they would, you know, that would make sense in that field. And so I've had, you know, students who've, you know, populated with rivers, a stream, a creek, wildlife, of course, gardens or flower beds or, you know, grasses of different kinds. And then I asked them to open their eyes and I asked them what they were thinking or what they were feeling. And it's normally, you know, it's the ideas of being calm or being at peace, right? And then I ask the question, did you ever wonder what the meaning of the field is? Like, were you trying to access why it's there? Were you trying to access its structure? Were you trying to access a possible message of the field? And the answer is normally no, right? Because you're not there to dissect the field, right? You're not there to extract anything from the field. You're there for, you know, you're simply there and you're simply seeing this field and you're experiencing yourself in seeing that field, which I think is the best way to approach poetry first, of course. As a poet and as also a reader, as a student, it's best just to approach a poem the same way you would approach a field, just experiencing it, taking everything in. And then, of course, if you're a literature student or anything like that, if you're a poet and you want to understand craft or you want to understand meaning or message, then you can go back. But for me, the best way to honor language is just first listening to it.
Well, there was a tweet in the last couple of days by Natalie Center Zapico about where she was quoting someone else about Walt Whitman and the use of free verse in relationship to the imperial enterprise of America that he, outside of his poems, supported. And you retweeted with a comment that I thought was interesting where you say that you teach your students that there isn't anything really that's free verse. And you relate the absence of a true free verse to this notion of our needing to contend with a field. Mm-hmm. Could you unpack that a little bit for us? I loved it, but I also would love to hear what you'd have to say.
When we talk about sort of having a colonial mindset or an imperial mindset, I think it's sort of ingrained within all of us because we all participate in conquest and disappearing and displacement because we're sort of given this mindset or this thought process of where we have to understand everything or we have to be at a place where we can negotiate or engage with a thing on our level. Right. So when we think about just the myths of America, right, again, going back to, you know, Manifest Destiny, American Progress, American West, it's always something that we can overcome and that we can participate in, right? And so for me, when I approach a poem and I approach it in a way where you want to experience it first, for me, again, it's a way of honoring that place, it's honoring language. But there's always this sort of notion or this drive or something that pulls us toward wanting to extract things from it, right? Which is both very, you know, in a literal sense, very real, right? When you think about, in order for us to have these things in our daily life, these conveniences, it's relied on extraction from those fields, whether it be coal, you know, gases, right? Those types of things. So from my eyes, it's sort of American progress is always driven by native populations or indigenous populations, right? Whether it be native tribes themselves and the resources they have on their lands, but also, right, when we think about labor, right, the way the most, talking about sort of undocumented immigrants and the workforce that they bring to America, right? It's sort of, and of course we can talk about, you know, historically America, right, talking about its foundation in, you know, slave labor, right? The idea that it's always on the backs of black and brown bodies that America is able to sort of progress and, you know, become this nation, right? And so for me, that's all under this precursor of trying, of this mindset of you have to understand something or you have to be able to overcome it, which I think is maybe just an anxiety or fear that we all have inherent as sort of people. And so when we approach free verse, right, there's this idea where then the page is this open thing that we can then conquer, right? We don't have, you know, we don't have structures, we don't have form, we don't have anything like that. So we're just gonna approach the page how we want to, right? For me, that's, and I totally agree with what Natalie retweeted.